Welcome to Between the Rows, the weekly podcast produced by Glacier Farm Media. I'm your host, Laura Rance. The terms genetic engineering, biotechnology, GMOs have been around and associated with our food now for decades. But sometimes it seems like we'll never get past the angst many consumers still have about the technology. Maybe there's hope. In this week's show, we're talking to a scientist who says the times, they are a-changing. We'll also hear from a leading environmental group that sees cattle and ranchers as part of the solution when it comes to protecting biodiversity. And our weekly look at the markets will zero in on what this week's report from the U.S. Department of Agriculture didn't tell us. But first, a word from our sponsor.
Your soil has a unique story. At Decisive Farming by TELUS Agriculture, we get that. Start using precise nutrient information to get optimal crop performance. Try our variable rate program risk-free today. Visit decisivefarming.com. Conditions apply.
This is Between the Rows. I'm your host, Laura Rance. Stephen Webb has spent much of his career as a biochemist looking for ways to improve crops for farmers and produce better food for consumers. He's lived through the controversies that have plagued efforts over the past 25 years to use biotechnology, including the backlash against genetically modified organisms. Webb is now Chief Executive Officer of the Global Institute for Food Security at the University of Saskatchewan. He says he's found evidence that public attitudes towards modern technologies have changed. But it didn't come out of a research project or a lab. He picked up on it at a burger joint.
The first time I ever saw an Impossible Burger was in Berkeley, California. And Berkeley, California is the home of organic.
Right.
And they were eating an Impossible Burger that was derived from GMO soy. And it had a plant or a flavor component that was derived from a yeast. And it was one of the most popular items on the restaurant menu. And again, I think it's a combination of recognizing, you know, for those people, for the people that ate that. And my daughter is somebody that will eat a regular burger one day and then decide when she's out, she wants a plant-based burger the next because she likes the taste. She likes the texture. She's not a vegan or anything else. Mm-hmm. She doesn't, my daughter and her friends don't care that it's from GMO soy or in here from Western Canada, the premium proteins from pulses, or that it has these flavor components that are from yeast. I think that it's looking at that entire sustainability picture in a different way. Because again, sustainability has three important legs: economic, environmental, and social. And when you look at the impact of genetically modified organisms, transgenic organisms, you know, they've actually contributed to a more environmentally stable ecosystem. Take a look at its reduced herbicide use. It's reduced a lot of things that have gone in that compared to where we were 25 years ago, 30 years ago.
Consumer interest in sustainability isn't the only thing driving change in the work by scientists at the Institute. Even though they're working with biological processes, they are now applying engineering principles. Now, we've all heard of bioengineering. However, these scientists are working on engineering biology. There's a difference.
So, engineering biology is a term that describes the integration of biology with automation, miniaturization, computer sciences, artificial intelligence, machine learning, and the application of engineering principles to biological systems versus bioengineering is engineering a single process in a biological context. It's the ABCs of bioengineering, which really distinguish it for our engineering biology, distinguish it from bioengineering. And the A is automation, the B is biology, and the C is computational. And that's the future of how work is going to be done in science, and more importantly, it helps accelerate the translation from discovery to development to delivery of innovative solutions for, in our case, we're focused around ag and food.
So is it applying the principles of just engineering to,
yes,
to biological processes? Okay.
Which is,
so
if, which, and again, from a biologist perspective, you know, I trained as a biochemist, and when we didn't know what was going on, when we lost enzyme functionality, we would say it went through a conformational change, which was code for it. We don't know what happened, but engineers are much more systematic and deliberative, and the application of engineering principles through the combination of automation, computational sciences, and biology allows us to answer questions in a way that biologists alone wouldn't be able to answer.
They call this the new ABCs of innovation. The combination of automation, biology, and computation doesn't change the way scientists ask questions. It just speeds up their ability to get answers.
It's not that I can throw 1,000 darts at a board and I'll get a bullseye. It's that I can be more deliberate about the 100 darts that I build to find out which darts are better and then improve the darts so that I actually do hit a bullseye. So design of experiment is enabled through this technology platform. And that's fundamental to being able to accelerate that innovation pipeline.
So when you talk about applying this to what we do here in Canada, and in particular Western Canada, what are some examples of the types of projects that the teams might be working on?
So for us, engineering biology in an ag and food context cuts across almost everything. So from an environmental perspective, things that we're very interested in are enhancing carbon sequestration and microbial, you know, looking at microbes and helping identify and improve microbes so that they are better carbon sequesters or better help plants better utilize nutrients in a way that's complementary. From a food perspective, a lot of the ingredients that we consume today that we don't even realize are essentially derived from this platform. So for example, a lot of cheeses that we consume, one of the key ingredients, rennet, is derived from this kind of process, which is the first key step in making the cheese. We're also very interested in looking at how do we improve processes. And here in Western Canada, where we're very focused on, you know, the protein industry supercluster and building out plant-based proteins, one of the areas that we're very interested in is the ingredients that make plant-based proteins taste like meat, like heme proteins, myoglobin, hemoglobin. We're also very much interested in thinking about enzymes that can improve processing efficiency. How do we enhance our ability to isolate proteins more efficiently? Or what do we do with those current how do we turn a byproduct like pulse starches into a value-added production stream for them? We get more out of our post-harvest processing side of what we're building here in Western Canada.
If there is one thing scientists have learned over the past 2 decades, it's that the words they choose to describe what they do matter. To that end, Webb is still a bit worried about how the scientific terminology will play with the public.
I also think, and honestly, I think we need to change the name and call it biomanufacturing is what we should probably be calling this platform. And I need to stop calling it engineering biology myself, because I think really all we're doing is harnessing the machinery that nature's given us. Nature's given microbes, plants, and we're purposing it, either enhancing what it already does or repurposing it to make things that we can't make using conventional manufacturing processes that are based around chemistry.
The Global Institute for Food Security has just received $3.2 million from the Canada Foundation for Innovation to build a new lab focused on biomanufacturing. The money, combined with another $5 million raised from private and public sources, will buy things like robots, computers, cell culture systems, and other equipment to support a wide range of projects. Stephen Webb says that could be a game changer for Canadian agriculture and food.
For us, the opportunity is that at GIFS, it allows us to play across a broader swath. And one of the fundamental things at the Global Institute for Food Security, our mission is we work with partners to discover, develop, and deliver innovative solutions for global food production. And we need to think about global food production in its holistic manner. So that processing side is a very key component to food production and food sustainability. A lot of the enzymes that are utilized in food processing are derived from animal sources. And there were disruptions of the supply chain, even here in Canada, related to COVID-19. So again, it allows us to think more holistically and how can we take technology that we already use today and leverage it into other spaces so that we can have that more sustainable, reliable, predictable processing side of things. I think it's a really good opportunity for us.
This is Between the Rows. I'm Laura Rance. Biodiversity protection on the Canadian prairies got a $25 million boost earlier this month from the Weston Family Foundation. The foundation is supporting the efforts of five groups to accelerate adoption of sustainable landscape practices through the Weston Family Prairie Grasslands Initiative. Those five include the Nature Conservancy of Canada, Ducks Unlimited Canada, the Saskatchewan Stock Growers Foundation, Grasslands National Parks, and Miwasan Valley Authority. I caught up to Kevin Tanique, the Regional Vice President for Nature Conservancy of Canada, to learn more. Hi, Kevin. Thanks for joining us on Between the Rows.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me, Laura.
Now, Nature Conservancy is one of five groups to receive the funding under this initiative. Will you be working together to coordinate how it's used?
Absolutely. There exists a great deal of cooperation and collaboration within the conservation community on the Canadian prairies. And those great working relationships are certainly going to be put to work delivering the many components of the Weston Family Prairie Grasslands Initiative.
Now, what are the goals of this program?
Well, temperate grasslands in Canada are one of the most terrestrial ecozones on the earth. And the goal of the program really is to accelerate the adoption of sustainable approaches to protect and restore our grasslands biodiversity.
So how do you measure success with something like this?
Well, you know, we'll certainly measure success through some of the conventional approaches. Like acres affected or the number of projects that are put in place. But there's also going to be some work done to develop more specific conservation and social and economic outcomes. So, you know, quantifying how much some of those habitats that were targeted were increased or what was the participation level of producers in these programs and how do they feel about the value of the programs to their farming operations.
Can you give me some specifics on how these funds will be spent?
The funds are going to be spent working with individual producers and patron groups that manage some of the provincial community pastures to improve biodiversity outcomes and on-farm sustainability. The projects are also going to work to protect priority prairie grassland habitats, research best practices to restore native grasslands, and also to explore the potential for a Canadian carbon sequestration market.
Now, do you have an idea of just how many of these lands would be publicly owned versus privately owned? I mean, you mentioned community pastures, but will you also be working with private landholders in this?
Absolutely. Yes, we will be working with many of the acres that we'll be actually targeting will be properties owned and managed by private producers.
Often when we think about protecting and preserving natural habitat, it involves restricting human use of it. And yet this announcement highlights it as an investment in Canada's ranching communities and the health and well-being of all Canadians. How does a program like this serve the multiple purposes that have been identified here?
Well, yeah, this program is focusing on what we don't want, Canada's greatest working landscapes, and there are significant opportunities for compatible use. So supporting viable ranching and livestock operations to maintain and protect prairie grasslands. And these grasslands also support or provide many important services to Canadians, from maintaining water quality, buffering our cities and communities from floods, sequestering carbon, and providing habitats to a vast amount of wildlife, and many types of which are at risk.
So, you know, and again, you know, when we hear the beef business, you know, those of us that live and work on the prairies are often surprised at how the beef business is portrayed as an environmental liability, you know, worldwide. And I'm just wondering how Nature Conservancy of Canada and other participants in this program, you know, have identified keeping ranchers in business and grazing on prairie grasslands as a priority. How does that mesh with some of the rhetoric around the environmental sustainability of the industry?
Yes, for several decades, NCC has worked in partnership with landowners and ranchers, the industry, Indigenous peoples, all levels of governments, working on maintaining and improving biodiversity of prairie grasslands. And we're quite proud to have moved past the perception that agriculture and rare species conservation are always incompatible. We certainly learned through the experiences following the BSE crisis from back in 2003, 2005, that when we lose producers, livestock producers, we lose grasslands. So we certainly are aware that livestock producers are great stewards of the land, and they are an important component of keeping grass on the landscape.
I've also talked to some biologists who talk about these natural prairie grasslands as being, and the species that the biodiverse species that have lived there actually need those lands to be grazed to some extent in order to support that bird wildlife that we often look to.
Certainly, grasslands they're a disturbance-based ecosystem. You know, for their entire evolution, you know, they've had the herds of bison grazing them, and Rocky Mountain locusts. They've had a history of a fire regime, and that has changed, you know, with industrialization and development of the Canadian prairies. And maintaining a grazing or a disturbance regime is a really important part of keeping grasslands healthy.
So what form will the supports that you're offering to work with producers take?
It will come in the form of the kind of direct to support to adopt practices that benefit biodiversity, access to technical support, and just really the acceleration of partnerships between members of the conservation community and individual private livestock producers.
And are there, like, what kinds of strings are attached? You know, if there's funding coming into an operation, what kind of strings are attached to farmers making the use of that?
Right. Well, there will always be kind of landowner agreements put in place, where the terms, the length of the term of the agreement, exactly what the cost share is, what the timetable and the various responsibilities of both parties are, so that there's a good, clear understanding that will provide a good foundation for a strong partnership going well beyond the 5 years of this program, we hope.
So it should be win-win for all parties.
That is exactly what the goal is.
Yeah. How soon do you think you'll have some of these programs up and running?
We expect to have the program development that needs to happen in the background done and be in the place where we can start to approve and implement some of these projects this field season. So this summer.
Well, we'll be looking forward to seeing how this plays out. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks very much for having me.
I was speaking with Kevin Tanique, Regional Vice President for Nature Conservancy of Canada. And now for our regular look at the markets. I spoke with Bruce Burnett, Director of Weather and Markets Information for Glacier Farm Media. Hi, Bruce. Thanks for joining us on Between the Rows.
Good to be here.
Now, there was a USDA report that came out this week. What did it tell us, or what didn't it tell us, is maybe the more important question.
Well, certainly there weren't any massive changes in the report, and for all intents and purposes, they probably just copied the February report and pasted it into the March report. As far as the wheat crop and wheat supply situation in the U.S., they left it virtually unchanged. So exports, ending stocks, all of those numbers that we look to for price indication or price movement really didn't change from USDA. They did make some interesting changes in the global supply and demand situation, where they decreased ending stocks by close to 3 million tons. This was built on the back of a 5 million ton increase in the Chinese feed use of wheat, which I think the market has generally accepted to be what had happened in China, where corn supplies were short, so they had used some of their wheat supplies for feeding animals, and as that's been related to their strong import program throughout this crop year. So again, probably a little confirmation, but the drop in wheat stocks still leaves us at record levels for the end of this crop year, and that really isn't necessarily very positive for prices. So on the wheat side, there was very little in the way of new news. In South American production, we did see some changes in soybeans. They reduced the soybean number in Argentina down a 500,000 tons because of dryness, but they increased the soybean estimate for Brazil up 1 million tons. So Certainly a divergent pattern there, but it really doesn't make a big difference to the South American supply situation. It's more or less now fairly well known, and at least within a range here. Although I would suspect that we're going to see some further changes to the downside, both in Brazil and Argentina in the coming months.
It's still, they've had like a shortage of rain, and any rain they've had has come pretty late in their season, hasn't it?
Yeah, for Argentina, they've been dry through February and into the first half of March here. And really, that's sort of part of the key growing period for their soybean crop. They do plant it in stages, so some of the soybeans may have managed to live off the January rains enough that they matured without impairment to their yield potential. But certainly any of the longer season crops, longer season soybeans, that is, really did get hurt by this drought. And the forecast is calling for even more dry conditions. So we're almost at the end of the growing season. We're starting to turn color. Leaves are dropping. So really, there's very little damage left to be done to the Argentinian crop. And I would suspect that we're going to see crop estimates maybe decline even further. We had a report from the Rosario Exchange after the USDA report, where they dropped their production from 49 million tons to 45 million tons. Again, the USDA number was about 47.5 million tons. So numbers continue to drop in Argentina because of the dryness.
So how does all that spill back to farmers here in Canada then, and the outlook for what they're planning to do this year?
Well, certainly, again, it does have an impact on our prices. Certainly for soybeans it does, but also it should have an impact in the vegetable oil markets. Argentina is the largest exporter of soybean oil in the world. So again, if they see a reduced crop, reduced supplies, they will have trouble exporting their soybean oil to the same extent as they have the last year, at least anyway. So that again, I think is positive for the oil markets. We're seeing soybean oil prices go up rather dramatically, and that's been one of the factors that's been supporting canola futures and cash prices on the prairies here over the past month?
Of course, here in Canada, the talk of the coffee shop, if we were getting together in coffee shops, would be all about canola. Just sort of where has that topped out yet, or where do you think that's going to shake out?
Well, again, it's going to be hard to call a top in this canola market, basically because we continue to export more than we need. We continue to crush more than we have in terms of total available, not necessarily in terms of need. So we're going to eventually run out if we continue at this pace. And the way that the market has to make sure that doesn't happen is to increase prices. So we probably on a cash basis are still going to see some extremely strong prices. I think the attention for the markets, and this is not only for canola, but for all of the commodity markets now, turning to 2021 and what the prospects are for increased area, increased production of crops, not only here in the prairies, but around the world.
So is there a lot of competition for acres then?
Most certainly. And again, we see this in prices in Western Canada because canola isn't the only crop that has rallied. We've seen prices for peas. We've seen prices for barley hit sort of all close to record highs or certainly cash markets that are very, very buoyant there. So there's a lot of crops available to plant this year at very good prices. So for farmers, that's really good news because, again, it means you don't have to disrupt your rotation too terribly much. I think, again, in terms of the prices for canola, certainly the pricing is aimed at incenting an increase in area. And I think we'll have a modest increase in canola area, but that's going to be constrained probably by the rotational aspects, as well as the fact that alternate crops are also priced at pretty high levels here as we go into the planting season.
I guess too, we are going into the spring with some extraordinarily dry soil moisture conditions. We'll be dependent on rains. Does that factor into what the acreage plans might be? I mean, are farmers going to steer away from canola, for example, that doesn't like a lot of heat and dry, or are they going to take the risk and plant it anyway?
Well, again, I think the price incentive is there to take some risk, but again, each farmer has their own sort of perception of what the risk is for the upcoming growing season. And I think in those drier areas where in a year when you would see, new crop prices for canola around that $14 a bushel mark lead to a flood of acreage, I think in some of those drier regions, you're probably going to see some hesitance, especially since we've also seen an increase in input costs, especially fertilizer here. That's going to make crops like peas and pulses a bit more attractive just because of the change in the cost of production there for crops that don't require a lot of nitrogen. So I think, again, we're going to see this mix out. What it does lead me to believe, at least anyway, is that we're going to see some just modest changes in our acreage. Wheat down slightly, barley area probably similar to last year, oat area probably similar to last year, and canola area up a bit. So those are sort of, I think, the factors that we're going to see here. And most certainly, if we continue to see dryness as we go through the early part of the planting period here, I think farmers will probably adjust to the extent that they can some of their sown area, taking into mind the prospects for getting the crop established well.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Bruce.
Thank you.
That's all we have for you on this week's Between the Rows, but I hope you'll join us again next week. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Laura Rantz.
Your soil has a unique story. At Decisive Farming by TELUS Agriculture, we get that. Start using precise nutrient information to get optimal crop performance. Try our variable rate program risk-free today. Visit decisivefarming.com. Conditions apply.